Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, July 17th. For the first time in almost 50 years, federal funding for public media is on the cusp of being zeroed out. What does it mean for public radio and television here in the islands? Who wants to be an HTA board member? The call has gone out to replace those who the governor asked to step down. We hear the perspective of one of the original founding members more than 40 years later. We meet an English teacher from Castle High School whose concerns about immigration brought changes to a National Educators Conference. Plus, what makes the robust fountaining of Kilauea's eruptions different than in the past? We hear from a scientist mapping the volcanic flows. And we meet a librarian with a side hustle as a sommelier. She explains how the two gigs pair nicely. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We have news this morning on the Trump administration's plans to claw back billions of dollars in spending that Congress has already approved. Much of that is foreign aid, and more than $1 billion is from the budget of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and that would have a direct impact on Hawaii Public Radio. HPR News Director Bill Dorman is here this morning with the very latest. Good morning.
Good morning. Aloha, Catherine. You know, we've been following this, as you know, since President Trump called on Congress to pull back this funding or to rescind it. We just heard on the NPR headlines, we're approaching the final hours, what continues to be a very contentious debate. It's now down to a final vote in the House. That could come as early as this afternoon. Hawaii time may slip a bit. Last night, the Senate narrowly approved this bill with an amendment, which added back some funding for foreign aid, but kept that $1.1 billion cut to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Now, those backing the bill say it's a chance to cut government spending. The arguments for keeping the spending also very familiar. That includes the funding for CPB in particular. And one theme that many lawmakers supporting public broadcasting have raised in this debate is the critical role of the emergency alert system. Last night on the Senate floor, Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono proposed an amendment addressing that very topic.
Mr. President, public broadcasters are essential to rural communities, often serving as the only emergency alert system when disasters or emergencies occur. These alerts can mean the difference between life or death. Public broadcasters around the country, especially those in rural communities, rely on significant funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is why Congress has consistently provided CPB funding on a bipartisan basis. By cutting funding for public broadcasting, this bill will jeopardize public broadcasters and the life-saving service they provide. My motion to recommit would ensure that no public broadcasting station that participates in the emergency alert system would lose funding as a result of this bill. As natural disasters increase in frequency across our country, this motion will help protect our communities and ensure they can get timely, life-saving information
when
disaster strikes. I urge my colleagues to vote yes on this motion.
Well, that motion did not carry. The Senate approved the rescissions package by a 51-50 vote. So now the House needs to vote on the package that the Senate just passed.
And so do we have any sense as to what the focus in the House might be?
You know, that theme of public broadcasting in times of emergency is likely to be one theme. Just yesterday, there was this powerful earthquake off the coast of Alaska. There was a tsunami warning that was issued for parts of the coast. And Alaska public media station KUCB in Unalaska in the Aleutian Islands stayed on the air. Eventually, that was downgraded to an advisory and then dropped. But an example in real time of one aspect, certainly, of public broadcasting.
Right. And with what we've been reading in Texas, too, and the flooding, you know, you just want people to get advance warning.
Exactly. Exactly. And now, so we're into this, the House needs to finish its work, vote on this by tomorrow. You heard David Folkenflik refer to that. Midnight Eastern time, 6 p.m. tomorrow here in Hawaii. If the House doesn't pass it, it's dead. could vote later today, could vote tomorrow. They've been going through some unrelated business in the House floor today. We'll continue to follow all this. Top of the hour newscast from NPR will have the latest. We'll also have the latest on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to sign up for station updates to get the latest delivered immediately to you, you can do that as well at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Okay. All right. But yeah, lots of listeners out there and, you know, supporters of PBS Hawaii as well would like to know, yeah, what's happening. But thank
Absolutely.
You so much, Bill.
You bet.
We've been hearing from HPR's Bill Dorman, who's been updating us on the status of funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
What's it like having an active volcano towering over you?
It's really a completely multi-sensory experience. You know, you feel the throb through the ground. The sound is kind of reverberating up through your body as well as in your ears. And then there was stuff exploding out the top.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Volcanologist Tamsin Mather takes us inside mountains of fire and ash. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Today on The Daily, the latest chapter in a dysfunctional relationship that has major implications not just for the American economy, but for the global economy. What's really at the heart of Washington's ugliest drama, Trump versus Powell. I'm Mike Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
It's been about a week since Governor Josh Green put out a call for potential candidates to serve on the board of the Hawaii Tourism Authority. We hope to get an update from him tomorrow. But today, we hear from one of the original board members of HTA. Back when it was set up as a quasi-independent agency, it will now be reconstituted as an advisory board. This morning, we got a chance to talk to former board member David Carey, who spent 25 years as an executive at Outrigger Hotels and Resorts.
I was involved with the group that lobbied for and got the original legislation passed for the HTA. And the mission at the time was to have a globally competitive, consistent fund for marketing for the state of Hawaii. And so the idea was you have a special fund that's dedicated to tourism marketing. And also there was pieces of it for the convention center infrastructure and a little bit to the general fund. And it worked really well. I mean, we suddenly had a dependable source of money that you could market. The original board was populated with several industry experts. There were hotel people, there were real estate people, there were airline people, and tour people, and so people who knew what was going on. And it was wildly successful. I mean, we turned the industry around. We brought the visitor industry numbers up, and that was great. And yet, over time, there was a lot of money feeding into that special fund, and as things go, legislatures always have other needs that they feel are more important than tourism marketing. So as you look at it now and you watch over a period of years, that money has gradually all drifted to the general fund. So I think it's something like $1 billion today now goes to the general fund. And we're back to where we started before the tourism authority. The tourist types have to go to the legislature and ask for money for the funding of tourism marketing. Not dependable. It's only good for the biennium of the budget. It's not an ideal situation to run a marketing organization for the state. But, you know, I understand their legislative needs and the like, but it's just, to me, it's that. And then there's been a lot of, how to say this carefully, involvement by legislators and others in the business trying to tell the tourism authority what to do, how to do it, all that kind of stuff over time. That's fine, except most people in the legislature, with all due respect, are not experts in tourism, yet we have lots of people. And so the board has kind of drifted away from that. And then there are conflicts, there are people's egos, and it's just really sad to me that stuff wasn't happening very well. So I can understand this notion of taking the power away from the board and giving it back to, I presume it's DBED in this legislation, but DBED's not really set up to do global marketing for tourism and negotiate deals with the PGA and movies and massive marketing plans that go to different parts of the world, and it's a global organization. So that's sad to see that happen. Oh, they've got this advisory board structure, and I'm not sure what it's going to do. When we started in the Tourism Authority, the mission was really clear. We were here to market in the state of Hawaii. Now, obviously, things have changed. It was pretty successful. Some would argue too successful. And now we've got lots of tourists. Some neighborhoods and some destinations are saying, hey, time out. We've got too many people. So there was a move to make destination marketing plans, whatever that is. And I always struggle to understand what that really is. And I think, in other words, it's, hey, how are we going to deal with too many people in an area? Are we going to have some way of dealing with it? Those are complicated government issues, which a marketing organization is really not well suited to handle. So I don't know. All that being said, now, theoretically, we have this advisory board. What are they going to buy? What's the mission of the HD? I don't know that the mission is really clear anymore. Not just marketing, is it destination management? Isn't that something that DBED and or DLNR should do? So, I mean, that's sort of a thumbnail from my perspective of what's going on. And I just scratch my head. Okay, how's it going to work?
Well, I think we all want accountability. Whoever is at the helm, you want accountability for lawmakers. You want accountability for industry people because it's important. And, you know, for whatever reason and whatever led to the dysfunction, which defunded HTA, and then now you've got this advisory board, but I'm not sure, and we'll find out soon, but, you know, who wants to be a HTA board member?
Well, what success? I mean, the question that, Catherine, is always, what does success look like? And that needs to be defined. I'm not sure what that is. I mean, if they define what success is, then it gives the board something to say, okay, this is what we're going to try to achieve. Now, and I'm not going to defend, you make an interesting point about accountability. I'm not going to defend, some of the boards and some of the people for doing dumb stuff, and especially recently, some of the free giveaways in the convention center. And there needs to be accountability. And at least when I was involved, there was accountability. It was very, very transparent. We'd provide detailed information on the marketing plans and the accounting. And the state came in and looked at the numbers. So I don't know how that process fell off the cliff. They've got to have a mission. And then an organization has got to be clear about who's going to manage the money and are you well set up? Do you have the right people to do that?
When we talked earlier, you had mentioned that attitudes about tourism have changed. You know, when HTA was created as a quasi-independent agency, you know, we were in some really tough economic times. And when that economic task force was formed under Ben Cayetano, Governor Cayetano.
And the mission was clear. And the mission was to bring back tourism to save the economy. And I would say, on hindsight, it was wildly successful. Now you point out correctly, we've got lots of tourists, perhaps more than we should have. And that's a thing going on around the world. Venice was complaining like about the Bezos wedding. There are destinations in other places in Italy and France are saying, wait, I got too many tourists here. So somehow that needs to be worked into the equation. But at the end of the day, someone has to define, hey, this is what it looks like. I mean, is 10 million tourists right? Is 5 million tourists right? Those are tough questions because they all have economic impact.
Well, you know, yes, we've all heard about the evils of overtourism. We've also heard numerous calls about diversifying our economy. We haven't quite figured that part out yet. But at this point, this is where we're at. This has been the golden goose. And yeah, it's like we've got to do a market correction here or something.
Yeah. Hey, a word about diversification. I know I've been involved in different committees and stuff over the years. That's a real problem. Tourism is one of the few businesses that actually draw money from other places. You know, we have two major sources of money from other places, if you will. Tourism and the military. The military kind of runs along. There's a military affairs council, and I've chaired that committee on and off over the time. And tourism. Most of the other businesses that they've talked about have been businesses that operate within our own world, so they're not bringing new money in. So that's a real problem. We've been talking about it forever, and we haven't come up with an answer. One editorial, if I may, which is sort of off the topic. I am disappointed, and I know there are a lot of cultures, that the astronomy piece isn't one of those diversifying pieces. It seems to me to be a natural, but I know that people feel strongly about some of the cultural elements, but we could own that business if we wanted to.
Yeah, I think on the science front, we are just so rich with the research that's going on over here, and you know, we could do better. I think we maybe sell ourselves short with
UH has done amazing things, but you know, at the end of the day, it's a year-to-year, grant-to-grant, and it's not necessarily a sustainable economic model, even though it may be the right thing to do.
Well, you know, when the pandemic happened, we learned a number of lessons, and we did see some very positive things happen. Lots of our local artisans went online and started to create, you know, an industry. What started out as a cottage industry, and then they were selling during the pandemic. And so there are positives in that the local people are benefiting from the mystique of Hawaii.
Yeah, because it's created here and sold elsewhere, so the money comes to Hawaii. I'm all over that. I think that's great.
Yeah, because
it's not big money, but it's some.
Yes, and I think maybe some of the feeling is, you know, we don't want folks who own prime real estate, whether it's hotels or whether it's the airlines, offshore companies, we want money to stay here. And obviously with, you know, the Kellys and the Outrigger and that history, you know, it is something to consider, though, that the local people need to benefit as well.
Right, but at the peak of my time at Outrigger, I think we had 5,000 or 6,000 employees throughout the state of Hawaii. So those local employees, as employees in tourism, benefit directly or indirectly, and it's not noticed, but it's really important.
I don't know. Anything else as we ponder where HTA and tourism goes in Hawaii?
Well, I think, to repeat myself a little bit, governor, legislature, DBED, whoever, has got to make it clear, what are we trying to accomplish for tourism? Once upon a time, that was ceded to HTA. I think there's some in government that thought that's not the right place, but we have to know what success might be and how we're going to get there. And that, to me, is unclear. So governor, staff, legislature, DBED, DLNR, whatever agency needs to come together and say, this is what we want tourism to be like. And this is where HTA's role is in making that happen. Until that's done, it's a little bit like bowling, you know, shooting in the dark. You don't really know what the target is.
All right. David Carey, thank you so much for your time this morning.
You're welcome, Catherine.
And that was retired Outrigger executive David Carey, who talked to us this morning about his experience and involvement with the Hawaii Tourism Authority when it was formed back in the 90s. Full disclosure, Outrigger Hospitality Group is an underwriter of HPR. Regardless of immigration status, those four words were inserted into the lobbying position for the National Educators Association at their annual conference earlier this month. A local English teacher proposed the language as a way to clarify that all students in the U.S. should have equitable educational opportunities, no matter where they were born. Jamie Stidger is a 10th grade English teacher at Castle High School. She stopped by our studios to talk to the Conversations D.W. Gibson about why it was important.
So the amendment was put into the legislative program of the NEA, which is the National Education Association, during our representative assembly that we have yearly at the beginning of July. The legislative program is what our lobbying team for NEA uses when they lobby members of Congress. So I added in these words into this place in our amendments to clarify who we are protecting and who we are fighting for.
And tell me what those words are that you had added into the platform.
The specific words were regardless of immigration status. And what I added into this, these words that I added into it are part of our values and our mission and our belief statements. If they weren't, it would not have been accepted. I just saw that this was kind of a gap, an oversight, that we needed to make it clear that we are fighting for all children in our public schools, regardless of their immigration status. And again, that's our sound belief, but words matter. I'm an English teacher and also an activist at the government level, and every single word matters. And these words have been wordsmithed through the decades. The legislative program stays as is, and then it gets amended and changed every year at the Representative Assembly. So I thought this was a noticeable gap, especially during these times of an administration who's trying to not only dismantle our DOE, but also coming after kids in our schools.
So you're spending time with the legislative program, and you actually notice, catches your attention, that this language is absent.
Yes.
Walk us through that process. Is this happening in real time at the assembly in Oregon, or is this something that you were prepping for before arrival at the conference?
This is definitely prep work. I've moved legislation previously. This is my 20th NEARA. So I often, pre-gaming it, looking through and seeing if things stand out. And it's been a minute since I've put anything on the floor, but this just kind of jumped out to me. And I think mostly because of what's in the air as far as what this current administration is doing and trying and continuing to do to public education. So, you know, maybe 4 years ago, it would not have stood out so much, but now it definitely did.
So you're at the Representative Assembly in Oregon, and you put this forward. Let us know a little bit about the sausage making, how that actually happens. You put the language forward, and then what happens next?
So you put the language forward, and there's a committee at the NEA level that looks through it and lets you know if it's friendly or unfriendly. If it's friendly, it gets put to the floor, which is about 6,500 elected delegates from around the country, to just approve or not approve. If it is unfriendly, it goes to the floor and it's open up to debate and then given a vote.
What are those characteristics in terms of friendly and unfriendly?
Well, you know, I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you kind of thing, you know?
Never mind.
It's all the committees comprise teachers and educators from around the country. So it's our people. They have their own process that they go through, but it's painstaking. They have to make sure that it abides with our resolutions, which are our belief statements. So when I originally put it in, it said regardless of citizenship status. And apparently the word citizenship needed to be changed. I had some people, I've been around a long time, I'm well connected, and I had people texting me when they saw it come out in print before it hit the floor and said I should really consider changing the word citizenship to immigration status. So I did, and it became friendly, and it was overwhelmingly supported on the floor.
Overwhelmingly supported. So no pushback on the floor, and everything went smoothly once you submitted it and it was identified as friendly.
Once they identify as friendly, there is no debate. They just, people, it's just the yay or nay. And there's nothing more disheartening than when you hear 6,000 people scream, no! But in this case, it was yay! So it passed overwhelmingly on the floor, yeah.
And you said a little bit about this at the outset, but tell us a little bit more about the practicality of adding this language.
That language will remain in the legislative program forever unless someone goes on the floor to try to change it and it passes the floor to change that language. So it will live on. The legislative program is the, I want to say the guidebook for our lobbyists, but it's more than a guidebook. It really is a script, so to speak, because they must follow this. In whatever situation they're in, they have to go by the guiding principles that have all been vetted and voted for by the duly elected delegates to the NEA.
You said a little bit about this, but say more about what motivated you to do this. You noticed that this language wasn't there, but what about your years in the classroom informed the decision to put this amendment forward?
I'm really, really glad you asked that question. I started teaching in 2000, and I was an ELL teacher for 18 years, Castle High School. An administrator, when I first started, hounded me relentlessly that it was my job to check my ELL students' citizenship status and immigration status. And I refused to do it. I said, absolutely not. I refuse to do this. This is not part of my job description. And I was hounded for nothing short of 2 years. And finally, year three, said administrator said, oh, you're right. So I knew back then even that there can be attacks on this population of our students. And as a public school teacher, I've always said, I will teach every child in my classroom, and every child in my classroom has the right to the same equal opportunity to a quality education. And this current administration scares me that that may no longer be the case. Like I said, they show up in my classroom. We are not ICE. We are not trained in that protocol, nor would I take a job that had me doing those kinds of things.
Yeah, and to that point, I know that the DOE released guidance for teachers with regards to handling law enforcement actions on campus should those arise. Do you feel like that guidance is sufficient and I guess I would say harmonious with the amendment that you put forward?
Locally, yes. At the end of the day, I count on my local teachers union and my national teachers union, which, by the way, is the largest labor organization in the country with over 3 million members, and they will have my back. So that's my guiding principle. State by state, it's a different scenario. And the federal DOE was created to ensure civil rights and equality for all people. That's why it was created. It was the height of the civil rights movement. And as you and I well know, there are plenty of states out there who would just as soon not give all of our students these equal rights and equal access. That's why it was created. And the fact that this administration is bent on dismantling it speaks volumes for where they stand with people that are in our country.
Are there immigration actions across the state and the country, something that students and families are concerned about? Is this something that you heard from students or families about at the end of last year?
Absolutely. Hearing it all the time, students and families are afraid. I think the biggest fear is the lack of due process. And again, this is a civil rights thing. It's due process isn't afforded citizens. It's afforded every single person who is in our country. And the fact that people are disappearing and people that are doing it, quote unquote, the right way, like these people, some people say, well, they need to do it the right way. Well, we have people that are doing it absolutely the right way, and they're being disappeared at their court hearings to do it the right way. So absolutely, even my students who are here having done it the right way and maybe even having gained citizenship are afraid because they are seeing that they can disappear because of the lack of due process.
Yeah, and the administration has threatened to go after naturalized citizens, natural born citizens, every category of person in the country.
It's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying. Nobody is safe from this kind of regime.
Well, as we approach the new school year, give us a sense of the atmosphere as you see it among NEA members, union members within Hawaii, when it comes to the effects, if any, that the federal government's actions on immigration will have on your ability to do your job.
At this point, I don't think we're going into the new school year with a fear of not being able to do our job, but there are so many attacks from so many other points at public education that I think we are all very aware of those, and we are not being complacent. We are organizing, we are fighting, we are doing everything that we can to protect all of our kids' rights, and this added part about the immigration status of kids is just one of a part of many things that teachers have to fight for, and it's relentless. You know, I'll have a teacher say, oh, I don't bother with politics, and I say, well, how privileged of you, because everything about your classroom and your job and your pay and your children and everything else that you do is a political decision, and that's why I find it very important for everybody, but most especially public education teachers, to be involved at any level that they can to keep our profession professional and giving our keiki the schools that they deserve.
I think what really stood out to me about what you just said there is at any level, right? One can go to the assembly in Oregon for the NEA, become a representative, do things on these bigger scales, but then one can also zero in on one's classroom, right? That's one way to become, quote unquote, politically active, is to zero in on the well-being of those kids.
Absolutely, and to not discriminate and to embrace all and give all equal access. And even simple things like writing letters to your Congress, showing up to a march, little things like that, they all add up. As you saw, like with the No Kings March, people that had never marched before were out in force in the streets, and that makes a difference. This is important because we need to do what we need to do, even if the government isn't willing to do it. We need to be the ones on the front line. We need to be the ones protecting our children and educating our children so we can have a more just society.
That was Jamie Stager, an English teacher at Castle High School, talking about what prompted her to speak out at a recent NEA conference to affirm that all students, regardless of immigration status, have a right to education. The The dazzling fountaining of lava from Kilauea Volcano has been delighting residents and visitors to the Big Island for the past 7 months. Our contributing reporter, Betsy Brown, joins us from Hilo this morning to talk about the eruption. Good morning, Betsy.
Aloha, Catherine.
You know, I'm so jealous. You're there, boots on the ground, and, you know, you're interfacing with the scientists that are, you know, knee deep. They're out there in the field.
Yeah, I was really happy and I'd say fortunate and had a stroke of luck last week because I got to speak with Mike Zoller. He's a field geologist with USGS. He actually goes out into the fields after the eruptions to look at samples, and then he also makes maps of the eruptions. So I had scheduled this interview with him in advance, and it just turned out that we were talking during episode 28 while the fountains were going off, and we planned the interview for the Kilauea Overlook because I wanted him to be able to point to the area and show like where things are happening. So it was really exciting. And those fountains were going off 1,250 feet in the more recent episodes. And that's a big number. And I've seen the eruptions many times, but it's still hard to understand exactly how big it is because you're still far away when they're happening. So the height of the Empire State Building in New York City is that height, 1,250 feet without the antenna. And then if you're walking around Honolulu, you can also picture it by thinking of the Central Ala Moana Tower. That's the tallest building right now, 435 feet. So three of those buildings stacked on top of each other. The fountain during the last episode was about 100 feet shorter than that. So it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I like that comparison. Thank you for that.
And those fountain heights, those of us who have gotten to see the eruption many times because we live in the area, will sometimes think that we're going to see a higher number when the reports go out. So I was curious about exactly what it is that they're measuring when they give us that height. So I asked Mike how they determine the height.
What we're usually measuring to is the optically dense part of the fountain. So the spot where you can no longer see daylight on the far side. So as long as it's fully opaque with either incandescent or dark material that's tephra in the lava fountain and we can't see through, that's the point that we're measuring to. But of course it varies. Like we see fluctuations even over the course of seconds to minutes. And so it's a little bit of an average that we're providing, you know, at like the peaks.
Yeah, it's interesting. As he was describing that, I was thinking of my, you know, chemistry classes and the Bunsen burners and the flames, right?
Yeah, I had wondered if it was where you see rock fall or if it's where the last bit of magma is. But no, like you said, it's where you can't see through it anymore. And so to get that measurement, they have a lot of different tools and ways that they do it. And field crews have a laser type device that they use. They take the source point at the ground level. They get, you know, the elevation of that, and then they take the vertical elevation of the lava fountain and then figure out the difference. But they also use their webcams, and they rely on them quite a bit, he said, because the webcams have scales built in, so they can analyze the images from the time-lapse camera, and that's how they get the definitive number at the end. And another thing that's been fascinating about the eruption is that these fountains have been happening in a fairly steady pattern of about one a week. And Mike says that's caused by the continuous movement of magma that just keeps going towards the surface, even when we're not seeing anything.
As each episode ends and the fountaining stops, we see an immediate switch to inflation. And the reason for that is because there's still magma moving from the hot spot, which is maybe about 20 miles below our feet here, in the mantle of the Earth. That movement of magma towards the surface is causing this repressurization in the shallow magma chamber. And then once it reaches some critical threshold that we don't fully understand what that critical threshold is, but it seems to be pretty consistent throughout this eruption because once it reaches a certain level on our graphs, very shortly after that, we start deflating and lava fountaining once again.
Yeah, there's so much we don't know.
Yeah, and this has been happening since late December. And we're seeing a lot of lava coming out. So I asked him how much lava is coming out, and Mike said up to 1.6 billion gallons has been coming out of the more recent episodes where they have been bigger. And Catherine, I know you're a swimmer, so what I did is I figured out how many Olympic-sized pools we could fill with that much lava, and it's 2,400 Olympic-sized pool. But to me, that's still a lot of pools to picture. So I decided to figure out how big of a road we could pave with that, and that would be 2,900 miles. So you could build a road from San Francisco to New York City with that much.
Wow.
Lava. Pretty incredible. And then you think of the fact that that's happened 28 times now, and some of them have been, you know, a little bit less amounts of lava. So Mike Zoller said it's 31 billion gallons that have come out so far this eruption, and some of that is flowing out into the crater. So the crater floor has actually raised 200 feet in some parts, and there's even more near the cone. And so the inside of the crater is looking a lot different. In fact, the cones from the eruption a couple of years ago that we could see for a long time, those are buried now. But it's also causing some changes outside the crater, because fragments of volcanic rock, they're known as tephra, those are falling downwind of each eruption episode. And you touched on this yesterday on the show in your backyard quiz.
Yes.
They had the field scientists. Yeah. Walking around with on the tephra fields with snowshoes. And it's because tephra is really light, and so it would be hard to walk in. There's actually a hill forming of the tephra around the rim of the crater, and some of the pieces are about an inch, and some of them are pretty big. After episode 27 a couple weeks ago, I went to the area that I knew was downwind, and along Highway 11, I found some bigger than a softball, and I picked it up to see what it's like, and it felt like it would be able to float on water. And so Mike told me that what I found was pumice, and he says that forms because of the gases that are in the magma as the fountain's going up.
And as it gets closer to the surface, some of those gases are depressurizing and forming bubbles. It's very similar to if you shake up a Coke bottle and you build all this gas pressure inside the bottle. And if you crack the lid really fast, then all those, that gas that built up in the fluid automatically flashes into like a foam of bubbles and shoots out the top of the bottle. Similar thing is happening here, where those volcanic gases in the magma are expanding as they get close to the surface and driving the lava fountain into the air. And then the tephra material is a mixture of those gases and the rock that's carried with it.
Yeah, so interesting.
Yeah, and then Mike said that most of this is going downwind, and that is within a closed area of the park. But there have been some previous episodes, like back in March, where there was Pelihara that fell in the golf course subdivision about a mile north of the crater. And then residents in the main part of the village east of the crater get that from time to time as well. But most of the time, winds are favorable for people inside the park and in the village. But Mike did say that with these bigger fountaining episodes we're getting now, if we have a reverse wind condition during an episode, it could mean some closures in the park and tephra falling in parts of the village.
Yeah, well,
but it's
fascinating.
But none of it would be devastating, you know, not like huge and damaging.
Right. Yeah, well, we'll see how long this goes on. But thank you so much, Betsy, for being on the ground there. Thank you.
Yes.
We have been talking to our contributing reporter, Betsy Brown. You can look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
By now, you are aware that federal funding cuts are reshaping our country. Public media and Hawaii Public Radio are not immune. This is Pia Arma. I am the founder of Pineapple Tweed Public Relations and Marketing and a longtime HPR member. If you're already a station member and looking for ways to help, please ask a friend or colleague to join you in keeping HPR strong. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org/protect.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from PAR Hawaii, committed to meeting the energy needs of Hawaii and supporting community nonprofit organizations across the islands. Learn more at parhawaii.com.
Are you living a double life? Well, today we're shining a spotlight on kama'aina with unexpected passions that they've turned into dual careers, starting with a librarian who moonlights as a sommelier. Crystal Kakimoto hails from the Garden Isle, and she's found a way to combine her two passions by leading Archives Uncorked events on Oahu, where its participants drink history. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about realizing that her two roles have more in common than meets the eye.
I graduated high school, and I moved to Oahu for college, and I earned a BA in history, and I had no idea what I was going to do. I didn't want to teach history. I didn't want to go into a master's program, so I ended up working in accounting, and it just so happened that the accounting office offered its services for a group of restaurants in Oahu, and after a few years, I kind of started hearing about wine classes that our master sommelier was offering, and his name is Chuck Furuya. He's America's first Asian-American sommelier and Hawaii's first master somm. And he was very kind. He let me sit in on the classes, and they were very, very informal, very introductory. It was really about why wine tasted a certain way or how food pairings worked. It was for the front of house staff. But I was hooked right away. And when he realized that I wanted to go a little bit further, he connected me with a few other people to have more formal classes, and I ended up earning my certifications that way. It was about that time also that my mom got really sick. She had very aggressive breast cancer, and she's in remission now, but it kind of woke me up to think, what am I going to do with my life? I knew that I didn't want to just keep working in accounting every day, and I did some soul searching, and I remember this very obscure but very intense desire to be a librarian. I remember being a kid at about 4 and just thinking the librarians were the coolest people in the whole entire world, and I wanted to be like them so bad. And I did more research about what librarians do and programs, how they serve their community, and I just threw caution to the wind and I applied. I got in, and in less than 6 months, I was in a program at UH Manoa, earning a graduate degree in librarianship. As soon as I graduated, it was about 2 years after the start of the program to graduation, I applied at Bishop Museum, which was kind of a pie-in-the-sky dream. I never thought I'd be able to work at Bishop Museum because it's an institution that I've just always idolized and appreciated my whole life. I started off as a technician there in the archives, and then I slowly worked my way up as one of the reference librarians today.
What a wonderful story with like twists and turns. And do you think that there's overlap between learning about wine and learning how to be a librarian?
Yeah, a lot of people don't imagine that there's overlap, but I remember being in grad school, and I was working at a wine shop to support my tuition bills. And I remember interacting with one of my customers, and they were huge champagne fans. And this was the holidays. So they were bringing champagne to all of their parties, and they liked a specific producer, specific sugar level, but they wanted to branch out. And I had this really cool moment when I thought, oh, this is like what I'm learning in school. It's called Reader's Advisory and Librarianship, where you sit with your library user or your patron, and you talk to them. You really try and figure out where they've been in regards to books, where they want to be, the style of books that they like. Do they like a strong female protagonist? Do they like a lot of dialogue? And it was the same thing with wine. What I found rings true with both professions is that you're always sitting with people and you're really listening to them and figuring out where they've been, where they want to go, and trying to help them get there.
That is so poignant. Yeah, I can think of times in my own life as a kid going to the school librarian and having them suggest what would become my new favorite series because they hear what I liked, or at a restaurant, a sommelier, same thing. They'll say, oh, do you like a white wine or do you like a full-bodied red? And from there, being able to give recommendations. Do you have examples of like either experience that you've been able to do that for a person?
Yeah. One instance that I think of is with an Archives in Cork event. It's a historical event that I take inspiration from the past and I bring it to the present with beverages. And I remember my first event, I was doing a pairing with a Kalakaua menu where he hosted Rear Admiral George Brown. And on his pairings was Sauternes, which is a dessert wine. And a lot of people, when I was starting my presentation, I said that we're going to be drinking a sweet wine, a dessert wine. Right off the bat, a ton of people said, I'll pass. I don't really like sweet wines. But I offered it. I had all of my pourings available. And I said, if you want to explore it, it's here. When they drank it, it was unlike any other sweet wine that they'd had because the grapes are affected with a botrytis fungus that looks almost like a velvet, and it dehydrates the grapes, and it just leaves sugar and acid. And it also leaves a residual, almost like a gasoline essence, gas in the best possible way. And I think that kind of intrigued people to think, what is this even going to taste like? And they tried it. And it's balanced because of that racing acidity. It has all of these interesting characteristics. And that's one of the times where you're kind of saying, hey, why not just try this and see where this takes you?
Talk a little bit more about that pairing event and just ones that have stood out in your mind, how it's evolved over time and how you work with the Historical Society to come up with these events that people really seem to like.
So what normally happens is they'll present me with the theme of the event, and then I have free rein, luckily, to do my research and see what speaks to me. In the past, I've done pairings that are based on King Kalakaua's coronation state dinner, which was really fun to do. That led me to a lot of research in newspapers to find out more context to the event, because sometimes I'll uncover a wine pairing menu, but I want to know more. I want to know who was there, who sat where, who ate what, what time were they ushered in, what time did they leave. And that was a really fun research journey for me. And then what I do is I look at the wines that he offers and I find modern comps, so similar wines. And from there, we're drinking history and we're trying to taste what he's tasting. I also did a really fun one maybe a few months ago where I looked at Queen Kapiolani and her travels, and specifically her travel with King Kalakaua when they went to Maui. And they were on a voyage throughout the main islands to talk about increasing the nation. They stayed in Ulupalakua, and that is the site of Hawaii's first AVA, Ulupalakua AVA. And I was able to pour wines from the vineyard where they actually stayed. It was so cool. That was also a really fun one because in my own day job, I was helping another patron. And we were looking for something for Queen Emma. There's a lot of crossover with Emma and Kapiolani. We took out Kapiolani's ledgers so we can look at her finances. And I saw that she glued two wine articles in the bottom of two pages. And I got really curious because why did these stick out to her? Why were they so important that she cut them out and she glued them into these ledgers where she's keeping her financial information? Mm. And it kind of led me down this very long research journey where I was trying to figure out what journals did this come from? What years were they published? Why were these important? And these were two really interesting pieces because they weren't superficial wine articles about this varietal tastes this way and it pairs with this food. They were very technical agricultural articles, which was even more interesting. So those are just two examples of the meandering research path that I've taken for Archives Uncorked.
Yeah, and figuring out that the queen knew her stuff, mm-hmm. right? You mentioned this idea of drinking history, and I love that idea, and I just want to sit there for a second and think about how that does broaden our experience of history or our understanding of it. So what does that mean to you, drinking history?
For me, as someone who has a background in history, you can look at it as a static event that happened, as something in the past. But what I like to do is I like to draw inspiration from that, bring it into the future, so that we are recreating it, re-experiencing it. And I think that the wine helps us give context to that experience. And I think going forward, it'll be really fun to share more of these historic events that really speak through wine. I'm working on a few with the Hawaiian Historic Society and Hawaiian Mission Houses in the present, where I'm talking about beekeeping in Hawaii. How did bees even get here? Honeybees, exactly. What role did they play? And I have all of these questions that I'm trying to answer. And then I'm trying to show people the connection in the present by offering mead. We're going to have a few meads to drink from Manoa Honey and Mead. And then down the line, I'm working on another where we're going to be drinking spirits at sea. And it's not just an understanding of why they drank spirits, but a further discussion on how these alcoholic beverages elongated journeys and improved the health outcomes of the crew and the passengers. And then I have an 1820s whiskey. That's a recreation of 1820 when the missionaries came to Hawaii. We're going to be having some batch cocktails to drink. So hopefully we're almost putting ourselves in the shoes of people who've come before us.
Do you have any other pieces of advice for people who have two passions that seem like they might be pulling them in opposite directions on ways to combine them and make a day job and a night job that are both fulfilling?
I would say that if it doesn't seem like your two passions make sense now, to just stay the course. And I think oftentimes something appears. I think that in my case, going into librarianship and wine, I didn't see the parallel or I didn't see the intersection point for a few years until I started really kind of getting into it. So I think that once you're working in your field for a few years or you have more experiences under your belt, hopefully something will start to materialize.
Trust the process. Mm-hmm. Anything else that you want to add or that you want listeners to know?
I hope people know that they can come down to the library and archives and that librarians are very friendly, very welcoming, as well as sommeliers. I think both fields are two professions where people want people to ask questions and we want to be there to support people through their journeys. So I just hope people feel comfortable approaching both professions.
And then give us a preview of the next Uncorked events, so dates and times and where people can go for more information.
Oh, yeah. So Archives Uncorked, the next event will be August 1st, and you can go to the Hawaiian Mission House's website to get tickets. It's an evening event, and I think it doors open about 5:30, and you can come in, you can have beverages and snacks before the official program starts. And then the next event will be in October. There's no set date yet, but it'll be on their social media and their website when everything's finalized.
And the October event will be a little spooky.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Amazing. Well, things to look forward to. Crystal, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was librarian and sommelier Crystal Kakimoto talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. The next Archives Uncorked event takes place August 1st at the shared campus of the Hawaiian Historical Society and the Hawaiian Mission Houses in downtown Honolulu. For more information, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, after the show. And if you have an unexpected side hustle or second job, drop us a line. We want to hear about it. Email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to reflect on 50 years of taiko drumming with Kenny Endo. Got some feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.